So, imagine for a second that you have like a massive, seemingly impossible goal staring you right in the face.
Right.
It could be starting a company that completely disrupts an entire industry, or writing a novel that actually gets published, or pulling off this massive career pivot.
Oh, yeah, the really intimidating stuff.
Exactly. You look at the mountain you have to climb, and a little voice in the back of your head asks this terrifying question, like, how do I know if I genuinely have what it takes to do this?
Right. Do I actually have the right stuff?
Yeah. Am I made of the right stuff, or am I just kidding myself?
Well, I mean, it is the central dilemma of human ambition, isn't it?
Yeah.
Most of us want things. We all have desires.
Sure.
But wanting is vastly different from possessing the foundational, unpolished raw material that's actually required to execute those things at the highest level.
And normally the way we figure that out is just, well, purely through trial and error, you know?
Yeah, you
We
guys
throw
up.
ourselves at the mountain, we guess, we fail, we wonder if we just need to try harder or if we're like fundamentally lacking something.
But today, we're unpacking the methodology of a man who just absolutely refused to rely on guesswork.
Which I love.
Right. We are diving deep into the system of the legendary boxing coach, Customato. I mean, this is the man who built three heavyweight world champions from scratch.
Most notably, Mike Tyson.
Rest.
Yeah.
Exactly. Mike Tyson. And we're pulling from a detailed analysis of his methodology called the non-compromised pendulum, specifically zeroing in on chapter five.
And chapter five is titled, The Mechanism of Selection and Implementation.
Which sounds very academic, but what is so compelling about this chapter is how aggressively it just upends all our modern assumptions about talent development, coaching, and, well, self-improvement generally.
Totally.
The sources we're exploring break down Dumato's psychology, his philosophy, and the exact sequence of, like, intense filters he used to forge raw, completely untested human potential into an absolute force of nature.
And the mission here for this deep dive isn't just to, you know, talk about boxing history. We are extracting Customato's highly unusual vetting process.
Very unusual.
Yeah. And his psychological framework, so you can apply this exact mindset to your own ambitions. We're skipping the typical motivational fluff.
Good, because there's plenty of that out there.
Right. Let's look at the actual mechanics of what creates a champion. And logically, that begins before a single punch is thrown. It begins with the selection phase.
Because Cuss operated on a very harsh but really practical truth. Before you spend years training someone, you must verify the raw material.
The unpolished stuff.
Exactly. You cannot polish a brick into a diamond, no matter how spectacular your polishing technique is.
Right.
If the fundamental atomic structure of a diamond just isn't there, you are just grinding down a brick.
Which brings us to his three-stage vetting process. And stage one is deceptive because it seems, I don't know, too simple.
Oh, it really does.
Yeah, I originally read it and thought it sounded like a standard, albeit high-stakes, job interview. But there's no resume exchange. When a prospect walked into his gym, Cuss asked them just one singular question.
And that question was, why do you want to become a fighter?
Just that.
Just that. That is the initial filter. And it's a completely binary pass-fail test.
Wow.
If the candidate answered that question in a way that failed to satisfy his criteria, the conversation was over. They were sent away immediately.
No second chances.
Nope. No follow-up, no physical tryout to see how hard they could hit the heavy bag. They failed on question one.
Which feels incredibly abrupt. I mean, what could possibly be the wrong answer to why do you want to fight? If someone says they want to make money or become famous, isn't that pretty standard motivation?
Well, standard, sure, yes, but fundamentally brittle.
Griddle. Okay.
Yeah, Cuss was listening exclusively for intrinsic motivation. If a fighter's why is rooted in vanity, social status, or even just like a vague desire for wealth,
Extrinsic stuff.
exactly, it's an extrinsic motivator. It relies on external validation.
Okay.
And under the agonizing psychological and physical pressure of the training system Cuss was about to put them through, extrinsic motivation just completely
It
disintegrates.
just doesn't hold up.
It doesn't. He needed evidence that the fire was burning from inside the house. The drive had to be a deep, unquenchable, internal need to prove something to oneself, not to the crowd.
You know, that makes a lot of sense. It reminds me of the difference between, say, a startup founder who wants to build a product to solve a problem that keeps them up at night
Yes.
versus a founder who just wants the prestige of saying, you know, I'm a CEO. The latter just quits when the funding dries up.
Perfectly said.
But let's assume the prospect survives question one. They have that intrinsic drive. Stage two is where the methodology takes a hard left turn into territory that honestly just confused me when I first read the sources.
Oh, I know exactly what you're going to say.
The sources detail that his second filter involved astrology.
Yeah, he specifically studied zodiac intervals.
Wait, really?
Yes. And at first glance, for a man so steeped in rigorous psychological strategy, this seems entirely out of place.
Mm.
I mean, it borders on pseudoscience.
Yeah, I struggle to understand how looking at someone's birth chart fits into a highly technical vetting process for a combat sport. Like, how did he rationalize this?
Okay, to understand the mechanism here, you have to look at Kusumoto's obsessive nature regarding data. He was a man who scoured every discipline, history, psychology, literature, in an endless search for any conceivable edge.
He was a sponge.
Absolutely. He was not reading daily horoscopes. He was attempting to categorize human typologies.
Oh, interesting.
He firmly believed that certain birth intervals contained different baseline temperaments or predispositions for the extreme aggression and strategic thinking required to become a world champion.
So it was less about mysticism and more about, like, rudimentary data modeling?
Precisely.
He was using historical intervals to predict behavioral baseline traits.
Exactly. It was a categorization tool. He was looking for any historical or interval-based data point that could give him a predictive edge on human behavior. He just highlights the absolute lengths he would go to in order to profile a candidate before ever putting them in the ring.
Which sets the stage for the final and honestly most intense part of the vetting process, stage three.
Right.
The sources refer to this as the recensorship grouped core, or the search for rare visible behavior.
And this introduces a really fascinating psychological framework that Cuss called the cabbage leaves.
Yes. Let's break the cabbage metaphor down because I think this is profoundly applicable outside of boxing.
Oh, absolutely it is.
The way the mechanism worked, Cuss would invite a fighter to his gym for a week. Now, the natural expectation is that the coach will run them through exhausting drills, correct their footwork, scream at them to push harder.
Like a boot camp.
Right. But Cuss did none of that. For an entire week, he would simply lean silently on the ropes and just watch the fighter exist in the gym.
Just absolute silence
and
observation.
Which honestly sounds terrifying. I mean, it's the equivalent of a CEO calling you into their office for a week and just staring at you while you work, refusing to give any instructions.
It's completely unnerving.
Why not just put them in the ring to spar and see what they're made of? Why the silence?
Because physical sparring only tests current skill, which can be taught. Silent observation tests the psyche.
Okay.
Cuss believed that a human being develops like a headed cabbage.
Yep.
From childhood, we accumulate these leaves. And these are our protective layers of societal conditioning, polite manners, learned fears, insecurities, defense mechanisms.
All the stuff we build up to protect ourselves.
Right. We wrap our true vulnerable selves in these leaves to survive and function in polite society.
And we spend our entire lives interacting with other people's cabbage leaves, don't we?
We do.
We present our professional polite selves, and we accept the professional polite selves of others. We rarely get to the core.
But polite society leaves will get you absolutely destroyed in a boxing ring.
I bet.
In a fight, extreme pressure strips those leaves away violently. But Cuss didn't want to wait for a fight to see what was underneath.
That makes sense.
So the silence, the judgment, the ambiguity of just being watched by a legendary coach, that creates a very specific kind of psychological pressure. It creates a vacuum.
And people despise vacuums.
They hate them. They eventually fill them with their authentic behavior. Geese was waiting for those leaves to peel back under the pressure of his silent scrutiny. He was looking for the central core.
And not just any core, right? The text explicitly says he was looking for a killer instinct, a rare visible behavior that just sort of flashes when the person forgets they are being watched.
Yeah, and he used this escalating metaphor for this. He said that if a boy comes with a spark of interest, he feeds the spark to make a flame.
Yeah.
He feeds the flame to make a fire. He feeds the fire until it becomes a roaring blaze. And when that central core is a roaring blaze, nothing on earth can stop it.
That's a powerful image.
But, and this is the really crucial part of the selection mechanism. Mm-hmm. If you strip away those societal cabbage leaves and find out the core is damp or the spark is weak, no amount of elite coaching will matter. The pressure of the world stage will simply extinguish it.
Wow. So if he saw that flash of the roaring blaze, the vetting was over. You were in.
You passed.
The selection phase ends and the implementation phase begins. And I have to say, This transition point is where my expectations were completely subverted again by the source material.
How so?
Well, think about how you typically build a disciplined warrior. You expect a military boot camp environment. Alarms at 4 a.m., drill sergeants screaming in your face, forced marches.
Fighting, yelling.
Right. Agonizing regimens where every single minute is dictated by the coach. But Cuss's method of implementation was the exact opposite of that. The sources describe the environment of his gym as an absolute democracy under dominating dictatorship.
It is a phenomenal paradox. On the surface, those two concepts just cannot coexist.
I know. I was trying to map this onto a modern workplace. It would be like working for a company where the boss demands literally world-class history-making perfection, but absolutely refuses to tell you what to do on a Tuesday.
It sounds like a recipe for disaster.
It really does. I have to challenge this concept. If you take a group of aggressive teenagers and put them in a gym with an absolute democracy rule, human nature dictates they're going to slack off. How does a coach build a champion without forcing them to do the work?
By establishing what he called the warning stage.
The warning stage.
Yes. The very first thing Cuss did after you passed the vetting was sit you down and set the operational rules of reality.
Okay.
He would tell the fighter, quote, I am going to judge you based on your deeds and not your words. I am going to see how bad you want to become a champion. I am going to watch what you do, not listen to what you tell me.
Oh, wow. So the era of the interview is officially over at that point.
Completely over. From that moment forward, no trainer in that gym breathed down a fighter's neck.
Yeah.
The facility was just open.
Seriously?
Yeah. Now, a standard professional training session requires 2.5 to 3 hours of grueling, repetitive daily work. But if a fighter wanted to know what drills to run or how to hit the bag, they had to walk up to the trainer and initiate the interaction.
They had to drive their own development.
Entirely.
Wait, so if a young prospect just walked in, taped up his hands, and sat on a bench for 2 hours, Cuss wouldn't intervene.
Cuss would not yell at him to stand up. He wouldn't say a word.
That's wild.
He would simply observe that the fighter's deeds did not match the ambition required for the championship level. And eventually, silently, he would stop investing his time in that fighter.
They just weed themselves out.
Exactly. However, there was a parallel mechanism running alongside this democracy. Cuss wasn't hiding the knowledge.
Right, he was still a coach.
Right. He would spend hours outside of the physical training, talking to the fighters, explaining the philosophy, breaking down the mechanics of exactly how a self-directed training session should be structured.
Okay, so they had the blueprint. They knew exactly what the work looked like.
Yes. They possessed the knowledge. Absolute democracy wasn't about a lack of instruction. It was a test of initiation.
I see.
They had to make the conscious choice to execute the blueprint every single day. This was formalized in what Cuss called the Agreement of Mutual Obligations.
The Agreement of Mutual Obligations?
It is essentially a sacred pact. He would tell them, I do my job, you do your job. If we both do it very well, then success is inevitable. It is fatal.
Success is inevitable. It is fatal. That phrasing, it just stops you in your tracks.
Doesn't it?
It really removes luck from the equation entirely. It frames success not as a hope or a probability, but as a mathematical certainty, a fatal outcome of two people perfectly executing an agreement.
And the brilliance of that agreement lies in where it places the psychological burden.
Right.
As the source material outlines, leaders differ from everyone else in two distinct areas, skill and will.
Okay.
Cuss, as the master tactician, could supply the skill. He could teach the mechanics of slipping a jab or throwing a hook. But the will, the sheer agonizing direction of effort required to make yourself do the hardest work imaginable when your body is screaming to stop, that must originate from the fighter.
Which completely explains the absolute democracy.
Yes.
I mean, if a coach is screaming in your face to do 10 more push-ups, your motivation is extrinsic. You're just doing the work to avoid the punishment of being yelled at.
You're acting out of fear of the coach, not desire for the goal.
Right. But in a results-only work environment, which is essentially what Cuss built in that gym, when no one forces you to hit the heavy bag, the only thing pushing you forward is your own internal commitment to that agreement of mutual obligations.
It forces total, inescapable ownership.
And it's a daily crucible for the will. Every time they stepped into the gym unprompted, they were fortifying their own central core.
Absolutely.
But holding up that heavy, self-directed mental burden every single day, that requires an unbelievable amount of resilience.
Oh, beyond what most people can imagine.
You are dealing with physical exhaustion, massive self-doubt, and the very real visceral fear of stepping into a ring with another human being who is actively trying to render you unconscious.
Yes, A very rational fear.
Exactly. So how did Cus ensure his fighters didn't just mentally shatter under the weight of that self-directed pressure?
Well, he couldn't eliminate the pressure, so he had to completely redefine their relationship with fear.
Okay.
He built a philosophical foundation designed to sustain the will even when the body was terrified. And this brings us to his philosophy of the hero and the coward.
This concept completely flips how we portray bravery in popular culture. I found this part so fascinating.
Right, because usually we visualize heroes as these mythical figures who are simply immune to fear.
Right, like action stars.
Exactly. We imagine they feel nothing, that their heart rates don't spike, that they just have ice in their veins.
They're basically portrayed as sociopaths who don't understand danger.
Pretty much. But Cus vehemently rejected that. He taught his fighters that in nature, biologically and psychologically, there is zero difference between a hero and a coward.
Zero difference.
None. The hero and the coward feel the exact same fear. They experience the identical spike in anxiety, the exact same anticipation of pain, the exact same knot in their stomach.
Wow.
Their internal physiological response to a threat is completely identical.
So if the internal experience is identical, what is the differentiating mechanism?
The mechanism of action.
Huh.
What makes a hero is exclusively what he does. What makes a coward is what he doesn't do.
That is so profound. It circles right back to the warning stage, right? Judging deeds, not words or internal feelings.
Precisely. This philosophy was the bedrock of a champion's psychological endurance. And Cussie actually provided a sort of psychological equation for this.
Math again.
Yes. The source material breaks it down mathematically. The concept of I want inherently equals fear plus emotion plus pain plus anxiety.
Because wanting something big is inherently terrifying.
Yes. Whenever you strive for a massive goal, your brain immediately retrieves all the past pain, failure, and anxiety associated with struggle. Cus explained that fear is literally just past experience trying to stop you from moving forward.
That's a great way to frame it.
And he taught that the goal is never to stop feeling fear.
Which is a huge relief to hear.
Right. The goal is to learn how to use that past experience, that surge of adrenaline, to your advantage so you become free of its paralyzing effect. You ride the fear. You don't extinguish it.
You use it as combustible fuel for that central core. And, you know, there is a story in the sources about Cus himself that just perfectly anchors this philosophy in reality. It's the story of the knife duel.
Oh, that is a profoundly revealing piece of his personal history. It demonstrates that he truly lived the philosophy he preached.
Yeah, let me lay this out because it's wild. Growing up in a harsh environment, Cus D'Amato found himself challenged to a literal knife fight, like a duel to the death.
Oh, in real life.
In real life. The meeting was set for an empty location at 5 a.m. Now, Cus openly admitted that he was terrified. He was feeling the exact physiological dread that the coward feels.
His brain was flooding him with fear, emotion, and anxiety.
Exactly. But he made the conscious choice to act out the deeds of the hero. He managed his fear, he got up in the dark, and he walked to the meeting point at 5 a.m.
And the outcome of that choice is what matters.
Mm. The opponent never showed up.
Wow.
The other man allowed the identical fear to paralyze his actions. He acted out the deeds of the coward. Cus D'Amato won a fight for his life without ever having to draw a weapon, purely through the management of his own fear.
And we cannot treat that story as just a piece of colorful folklore.
Oh, no. It's a case study.
Exactly. It represents the ultimate strategic objective of his entire boxing system, invulnerability.
Let's explore that mechanism. How does conquering your own fear translate into physical invulnerability against someone else?
Well, Cus realized that if you can master your fear while your opponent remains enslaved and paralyzed by theirs, you possess the ability to win situations before they even physically begin.
The fight is decided before the opening bell.
Exactly. Okay. And in the boxing ring, this psychological invulnerability translates physically into his famous peekaboo style of boxing.
Ah, right. The style Mike Tyson used to terrorize the heavyweight division.
That's the one. The mechanics of the peekaboo style are entirely about hitting the opponent from a physically impregnable position.
So, hands high.
Yes, the fighter's hands are high, protecting the face, the chin is tucked, the body is constantly slipping and weaving. You are entirely covered up, managing your own fear, safely advancing on the opponent.
Unstoppable.
Right. To the opponent, you appear as this armored machine that offers absolutely no targets, and it causes their mind to break.
Man, that's intense.
Cus deeply admired a fighter named Henry Armstrong. and he described Armstrong's effect perfectly. He said Armstrong destroyed the will of his enemy and shackled his soul and turned all his intentions into damn lies.
Turned his intentions into damn lies. That is an incredibly poetic way to describe psychological destruction.
It really is.
It's not just about dodging punches. It's about presenting a physical manifestation of absolute will. Your opponent realizes their punches are useless, their strategy is useless, and because your agreement with yourself is unbreakable, their spirit just shatters.
It is the fatal success he promised in the agreement, realized in real time.
Amazing. So bringing this all back down to earth for a minute, the vast majority of us are never going to step foot in a professional boxing ring.
Probably for the best.
Definitely for the best. We aren't training to slip jabs or throw hooks, but we are all trying to achieve something difficult. We all have that massive, seemingly impossible goal we talked about at the very beginning of the deep dive.
And crucially, we all walk around wrapped in our own cabbage leaves.
We absolutely do. We have those protective layers of very reasonable sounding excuses, the societal norms that tell us to play it safe, the inner voice that says, I'm too tired today, or I'll start that project when the timing is perfect.
Right.
Think about the agreements of mutual obligation in your own life. The promises you've made to yourself, to your family, or your team. Are you sitting on the bench in the gym waiting for a boss, a partner, or a drill sergeant to scream at you to get up and do the work?
Or are you operating in an environment of absolute democracy where your deeds are speaking for you entirely unprompted?
It demands an uncomfortable level of total ownership. And part of that ownership is recognizing that the intense fear you feel when looking at your goals is not a signal to stop. It is entirely biologically normal.
It's just human nature.
Exactly. Remember the core philosophy. The hero and the coward feel the exact same fear. You are going to feel a knot in your stomach before you launch that business or before you make that massive career pivot or before you publish your work.
You're going to feel crippling imposter syndrome.
100%. But feeling that doesn't mean you lack the raw material. It doesn't mean you are a coward. It just means you are standing at the starting line, experiencing past memories, trying to protect you. The only thing that determines your identity is the mechanism of action.
Yes.
What do you do next? Do you let the fear paralyze you, or do you show up at 5 a.m.?
You know, as you navigate those decisions, I want to leave you with one final hypothetical to analyze today.
Let's hear.
We've spent a lot of time examining the intense silent pressure of Customato's vetting process. I want you to imagine that you are working on your biggest, most deeply held ambition.
Okay.
And imagine that Customato is invited into your workspace for 1 week. He doesn't offer you advice, he doesn't motivate you, and he doesn't critique you. He simply stands silently in the corner, leaning against the wall, watching how you handle the pressure of your own expectations.
Oh, wow.
Under that silent scrutiny, what rare visible behavior would break out of you? Once the polite cabbage leaves were stripped away, would he see a central core that burns like a roaring blaze, or would he send you home?
That is a profoundly heavy question to sit with, but perhaps the most necessary one to answer. Until next time, keep digging into the sources, keep stripping away those cabbage leaves, and we'll see you on the next deep dive.